I would also like to extend my very warm welcome to you all. It's lovely to be here, back with London Insight and many of you I know, and some very well. It's a very warm welcome. And those of you who are perhaps new to London Insight or that I haven't had the chance to meet before, very happy that you're here. The theme of the weekend, as I hope you know, is the contemplation of death, of our mortality, and its implications essentially for our life. So, in terms of the form of the weekend, there'll be some meditation, and I won't be giving a lot of meditation instruction. It won't be the only or necessarily even primary thing we're doing, but there certainly will be some meditation. Please come in. Is there a seat somewhere that you can see?
Oh, there's one here.
There's a spare chair. If you're fine there. Do you need any more cushions? There's some mats here, actually, I think. Maybe we'll get you one afterwards. Okay. Yeah, just bearing in mind, actually, how many people of us there are here. Does everyone have enough of what they need to sit on? Because there are a few more items here. Louise kindly brought me some yoga blocks, which is what I like to sit on, but I don't need all of them, so there's a spare one and there's some other mats. Which
more cushions.
And there's more cushions at the back, or at least there was before. So.
Yeah,
I think it's okay to borrow something if needed. Yeah. Yeah. So if you just bear in mind with that block, that's Louise's, and go back at the end. Is that okay, Louise? If someone else uses it. Thank you. So I will give some instruction for meditation, but it won't be in great depth or detail. And with that, I'm assuming that most, and maybe everyone here, will have some experience. I know some of you have a lot of experience, but that most of you will have some experience of meditation. And I'm just wanting to check, but it's okay if you haven't, but is there anyone here who hasn't engaged in any form of meditation? I guess you wouldn't know if it was similar to insight meditation if you hadn't. But where you've spent any little time in silence or just contemplating your inner experience in some way or form. Is there anyone here for whom that might be the first? This might be the first time you're doing that. It's useful for me to know. It's fine if it's the case. Okay, so that's good. And is there anyone here for whom being, and I'll say a little bit more about what this means, but sort of predominantly will be in silence, which means that we won't be engaging casually in conversation with each other. There will be some spaces where we will share in different ways and forms, and there'll be some maybe interactive period as well in the weekend. But is there anyone who hasn't been in a situation like that before? Again, it's really fine. This isn't an entry requirement, but it's useful for me to know in terms of how I'm framing things. Okay, great. Good. Okay, well done for coming along. And I'll just say really briefly with that, the value and the significance of being in silence isn't somehow about sort of removing ourselves or distancing ourselves from other people necessarily in the way we might think of it. You know, if we've been bad and we're told to go away, or someone's angry with us and they won't talk to us. It's much more, if we're not engaging in that normal common, and this some of you are very familiar with, but in that normal common verbal way, it really leaves us much closer with ourselves. And that's what's important here. It's that sense of coming into contact with ourselves. And so the practices that we'll be exploring in the teachings are, there'll be some meditation, but a significant element is contemplative, in the sense of looking at, in a reflective way, the truth of our experience. And contemplation in this context isn't something whereby we just think about our experience, because we're all probably pretty well trained and well sort of experienced at thinking about things. Contemplation includes an element of thought, but it's very much about being in contact with our direct experience and allowing questions to run deeper into our hearts, into our minds, into our bodies, in fact. So that the questions or the themes we might reflect on are not just to see, oh, what does my thought produce in responses, but to know also, what am I heart responses, my emotional responses, what are my body responses, the visceral responses, that information is actually really helpful, is really useful in engaging with the, we could say, more significant or deeper questions of life. And clearly, certainly it seems to me that the topic of death and contemplating death, this is one of the fundamental and, we could say, deeper questions. Now, what does this mean for us? And so, there may be many reasons why you've come along today. It may be, for some, it's just some curiosity. It's an interesting thing. It's not what one generally talks about at lunchtime at the cafe. So, let's see, you know, what's going to happen. It might be that, for some of you, of course, you've had encounters, and most of us will, in different ways or degrees of closeness with death that have left us with questions or concerns or fears or wonderings with those close to us, or just being aware of the fact that, you know, what's reported in the news regularly describes the death of human beings. We see that. And that we may have, you know, lost people near to us. It happens for most of us. Somewhere along the line, we may ourselves be in a situation where our health or our condition has clearly been reported to us as one in which, you know, we don't have so much time left. And death becomes a very immediate question, concern or interest for us. So there can be a lot of reasons why we come, and actually it's fine to have come for whatever reason you've come here for. You don't even actually have to have had a reason. It might be, oh, there's something happening, I'll go along. Why not? But just notice, and certainly I notice, even just turning the attention to the possible reasons one might have come here, there's a certain weightiness, a certain gravitas to the territory. And it's one which, you know, socially, culturally, we often shy away from a little. Even though, as I said, it, you know, the facts, the information is reported on the front pages of newspapers whenever significant numbers of deaths occur in any situation that are somewhat out of the ordinary, just death by so-called natural causes. And that. But apart from that, there's a way in which we don't really take it on in our culture as a topic of reflection or engagement. Sort of an interest, and at the same time a bit of a sort of a uncertainty, I would say, for many, about, you know, how close to this topic do I want to get? And I'm wondering, does anyone recognise any of that for themselves? You know, a sense of, yeah, sort of interest and sort of not interested. Yeah, that's understandable. So we all have some chance to explore over this time our responses, our relationships, as well as our experience in whatever way it's real for us. Actually, I just realised there's one other thing I wanted to ask as a preliminary question, because I taught a day long here in London on this topic a couple of years ago, and I'm curious, and it's again fine, how many people might have been there at this one? So there's, okay, there's a couple. So in some ways a certain amount of the material will be familiar in one sense, and yet the contemplation can always be fresh. The framework for the invitation to contemplate might be one we've heard some of before, and many of you may have encountered it in other situations likewise. What it means to come to a contemplation in a way that can be really meaningful is to allow ourselves to be more fully here, more fully in the actuality of our experience. So it's okay if along the way you want to make the odd note or write down something that seems significant for you. There will be space and time for questions, reflections and sharings. My suggestion to you is to not try and record too much in terms of writing down, because that process of recording things for later often takes us a little bit away from the here and now experience. And that's really where we can learn the most. I think, in fact, seeing the red light on, assuming this is being recorded?
Yes.
It is. Okay, so thank you, Gary. The light is on, yes. Yeah, I'm assuming it's doing its business rather than I mean, it looks like a small metal insect that's sort of contemplating the jump, but I don't know. So you'll have the opportunity, if you wish, to go back and review what I've spoken about and what we've done together without having to have recorded it for yourself. So my suggestion would be only if it's something that particularly stands out for you that you can just capture in a very brief few words, then of course very fine to do that. But part of what's helpful is simplifying the day. So leaving aside if you have brought something to read at lunchtime, I'd suggest you don't do that. Even if you've brought a book on contemplating death to read at lunchtime, I'd suggest you don't do that. It's fine, but there's other time for that. Maybe not this weekend. And in terms of the silence, to let it be an invitation to listen carefully. So rather than it being the silence of sort of my mouth is sealed and no sound shall pass my lips, or that sort of kind of idea of I'm doing it now, I'm being silent. It's more like as if we were to take this time as the part of a conversation in which we were just listening. Knowing there'll be a time to speak and respond, but right now we're just listening. And do you have a sense of that? That it's appropriate to be silent when somebody else is speaking? You know, it doesn't make any sense if we all talk at the same time. And so to hear sometimes the quieter voices, we need to give a little space. A little, you know, you've been in a situation with a group of people and there's someone who hasn't said much. And you just need to all pause a moment because maybe that person needs a little more space than some of us who just jump in. And then you see, oh, actually it was good we did that because that person had something important to say, but they weren't going to elbow their way into the middle and say, oi, listen to me. Yeah? Sometimes the wiser parts in our hearts and minds are a bit like that. They have a lot to tell us. But we need to learn to listen. And some of what the practice of contemplation involves is that listening capacity being supported and developed and deepened. So in terms of making contact with ourselves, in terms of actually being here for this, meditation is a real, a really important support and a vehicle for inner sensitivity and openness and for this capacity to listen and to meet our experience with our faculties engaged. So we're not trying to disengage our mind here, but we're not wanting it to override the other senses, the other capacities we have for receiving, for understanding, and for responding to our experience. So let's just have a little time for some meditation, just as part of the process of landing. Thank you. kind of interesting being this cozily together, we could say. I was going to say packed, but maybe that word doesn't need to be used. We have the question of, you know, shall we take a few more people and be a bit more, in a way, closely packed? Or not? And my view in terms of this and my experience as a Dharma teacher, one of the things that is really in the tradition is that the Dharma is not taught behind closed doors. That's something that's available, and you know, because of the circumstances, we need some kind of building to protect us from the vehicles and the elements, it seems. But so far as possible, my personal view is that having the opportunity to come and listen to teachings and practice is important, and sometimes we have to put up with a little sort of discomfort or things being not quite as we might prefer. And that's not necessarily how we normally tend to view things. We might think, you know, I want my space and my sort of comfort, and hopefully there's enough here for that to work for you. Of course, easy for me, I've got all the space up here. But actually, we will reorganise it in a little moment, and if anyone is so inclined, we might make use of some of what's up here as well. It can also work. There are people sitting at the side facing this way, so the back to that wall and that wall. We'll see if we need to do that. So, the contemplation of death is as I said, it's a subject which, like, we see it on the front of the newspaper or in the news, this many people died, this terrible thing happened, but the way it's presented is often in a, to me it seems that it has a sense of, like, we're not really asked to engage with the reality of death. We're kind of just being, in a way, impacted by it in a way that tends, I find, to lead to a certain kind of shutting down. Like, I'm not sure I'm letting this in. It's the way it comes, because it's like it's talked about or it's put out in ways that doesn't quite seem to fully include what is being talked about or expressed. That's not always the case, but for me, I really find it an important and an actually exciting topic to engage with. Because, actually, can I get a volume check? Can you hear me all right? And if you ever need me to speak more loudly or slowly or explain any of my idiom, please wave and ask. You're welcome if you need to. And likewise, welcome if you need to adjust, change position as we're going. You can do that. But I find myself quite inspired and engaged by the topic for many reasons. But essentially, it's something that for me has been a fundamental orientation or a territory or an area of experience in terms of how I've been impacted by it that has really made a difference in my life, and it's actually in some ways responsible for me even being sitting here. I'll maybe speak a bit about that somewhere later in the day. But in terms of the teachings of the Buddha and a number of the reflections that I'm kind of drawing on will be drawn from what he had to say about this topic. From his point of view and the teachings that of the Buddha, often people think of, you know, meditation or sort of contemplating, you know, profound emptiness or sort of such things as what the Buddha was on about. And yet the Buddha, as one of the fundamental things he encouraged people to reflect on, was the fact of our mortality. To really acknowledge the centrality of importance of this fact in our lives, that without acknowledging it, our lives are lacking something essential. And so turning our attention to this is a way of inviting a certain possibility, both a deepening and an opening of our sense of what it means to be alive. And our experience of this remarkable thing we call, quite casually, being alive. as if it was just kind of taken for granted, which mostly we do, being alive. So in the Buddha's story, and it's kind of interesting, we actually have the Buddha's story mapped out around us here, I think. I don't know if it's got these particular pieces in it. Yeah, it's probably here somewhere. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'm not familiar with this room to know exactly.
Well,
but
sorry? I say birth is over here, so it's really bad somewhere.
Yes, I don't think this is that necessary, but if birth is over there, then probably the encounter with what's known as the heavenly messengers is there somewhere too. And the Buddha, in his own story, was described as, that's the Buddha's death, that's probably the last one in the cycle, so maybe that's his birth there. Anyway, I'll check it later, maybe you might want to, but for now let's not get too involved, even though I have a little bit sent you that way. Let's send you another way. The Buddha himself, in his life, and you're probably familiar with the story, had a kind of initially apparently comfortable sort of first 29 years, and then had a very powerful experience or series of experiences where he encountered other people. It seems apparently for the first time, because of his sheltered life, he encountered people in situations he hadn't seen before. Someone who was ill, someone who was aging, and someone who was dead. And his encounter with each of these scenarios or these beings was to wonder, how did this happen and will this happen to me? Someone's getting sick. And his companion at the time says, yes, it happens to all of us, we get sick. And someone getting old, his companion responds when he says, will this happen to me? Yes, it happens to all of us, we all get old. Seeing someone dead, a corpse, for the first time, age 29, says, How can this be? Will this happen to me? And his companion, his charioteer, in fact, says, yes, this happens to all of us. And this so profoundly affected the young man who was then sort of the son of a wealthy and noble family in India 2,600 years ago, approximately, that he started to wonder what was important, what was meaningful in his life. He also had an encounter, and many of you know this, with a renunciate, a spiritual practitioner who was living a very simple life and realizing that there was something the person was interested in, was looking for, was seeking to explore and understand, that immediately came into focus for him in terms of spiritual practice or a spiritual quest once he recognized, once he heard the fact that, oh, I'm not going to be here forever. And in some way he got that, because sort of we know that, and you know, we're not so different. Maybe we didn't grow up in a palace and all of that, but in some ways we're a bit like that too. We sort of know it, but we don't necessarily really take it in. And that is what's important about taking some time to contemplate, to reflect on, and to allow ourselves to be affected by this theme, this topic, this truth, in fact, of life, that it is not forever, that this that we call body, heart, mind comes to an end for all of us, inevitably. And so reflecting on this, we see that it's useful to be reminded. It's useful to be reminded in a way that we can actually receive, not in a way that overwhelms us or disconnects us, but in a way that actually touches us. It's useful and important to be reminded. And yet, to a large degree, in our culture and our society, there's a very well-developed and refined way in which we're kept distant from the reality of death. The sort of the fact of it is spoken about in a certain way, as I said, on the front pages of newspapers, regularly this many people died in that event. You know, it's there in a sense. So it's not like it's that far away. But in another way, we don't actually really meet it. We don't see and feel what that is, because the whole process of dying is something that's mostly become institutionalised and removed from our view. Unless it's ourself or someone very close to us, we don't really encounter it as a day-to-day event. There's a certain tidying up that goes on through medical and other modes of handling things. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that per se, but if as a result of that we don't really make contact with the effect or the way we're affected by this truth. So it's informational. We get it at an informational level when we hear it on the news. But that's different because information tends to just generate more information. That's the nature of it. That's part of why when we come to meditate we find our mind going round and round because it gets fed a lot of information coming at us in all directions, out of speakers, out of screens, out of pages of paper, it's words coming through our ears, coming through our eyes, coming through the very vibration we feel as we move around in the city and the intensity of what's going on. And it just tends to generate more and more. And so, from a Dharma perspective, from a perspective of spiritual teachings and practice, it's useful to be reminded, to have those things around us that remind us of this. And it's very interesting, the retreat centre, Gaia House, where I live nearby, and quite a few of you are familiar with many of the teachers coming to Insight, Blended Insight are connected with Gaia House. And when we were in the process of moving from the small convent, which we began in some 28, 9 years ago, to the larger facility we have now, a couple of miles away from the original site, there was this old convent was being sold because the order had slowly become smaller and smaller until there were just five nuns living in a convent with, you know, 50 rooms in it. And they couldn't really sustain that. In fact, particularly they couldn't sustain the heating bill, which we've been paying for ever since. But when they decided they had to sell it, and Gaia House, we were bidding for it together with a couple of other organisations, one of which wanted to run a family holiday camp, and the other of which wanted to establish an old people's sort of retirement care home in the facility. And the nuns had a graveyard, and have a graveyard, on site. Some of you will know this. Just simple, enclosed space, little wooden nameplates, no big memorial things. But part of what they wanted was that this would be remaining sacred and taken care of, and actually that they would have the opportunity for those who lived there many years, if they wished, to be buried there. And it was very interesting because, as you can imagine, if you're wanting to have a family holiday camp, it's sort of like, you know, do we really want that in the middle of, you know, hey, come and have a nice time in Devon? No. And if you're going to have an old people's retirement home, it's like, no, that's not really what you want to have in the glossy brochure, come and feel at ease here, you know. But for us, it was like, great, our very own graveyard. It's just contemplation for us. Offered like that. And, you know, we didn't offer as much for what is now Gaia House as some of those other people were able, those other organisations were able to. Ours was not the highest bid. But the nuns chose to sell it to us because, A, it was a sense of some continuing of spiritual practice then, but B, because actually we were really enthusiastic and happy to have a graveyard in the middle of our premises. And since, you know, we've had it now 15, 16 years, at least one of the nuns has been buried there. I was there at the time. There may have been another one that I wasn't aware of, but I think it's probably just one of the nuns who were living there who came. And it's just really interesting, this thing of, you know, there's a piece of grass. And then the next day, there's a hole in the piece of grass and a pile of dirt beside it. And then the next day, someone has put in that hole, it's covered up, and there's a little mound. And that's it. Someone is in there, or what is left of someone is in there. And then the mound starts to settle, the grass starts to grow, and 12, 14 years later since that happened, you can't tell. I can't tell which was the one that was in there last. Very interesting. Just that whole process. And just having it that close and watching what happens in a graveyard. So I'm in there pre-regularly, and I go and look at that. It's got tears. At some point about 5 years ago along this line. A practitioner, a student who had come and sat a lot at Guy House, who was also in medical training, had the opportunity to procure a real human skeleton for Guy House. And there was quite some debate as to whether this was something we could actually put in the house. Because although it's actually quite traditional in Asia, in monasteries, often there are skeletons or even piles of skulls of the generations of monks or nuns who've lived there, and they just say, look, the last thing I can offer the world is just the view of my bones. And that's part of what they do. But in modern Western culture, is it okay? Will people get freaked out? Will they say, oh, I can't go into Guy House, I've got a skeleton there. And yet we said, actually, no, this is important. We want to not shy away from this. And in a sense, you're all here because on some level you're choosing not to shy away from this. Maybe some of you have seen this cross-legged knot. That we're trying to make it look like it's meditating. That's just how they put them together, put that one together. This person just sit and contemplate, gosh, this was somebody. Those bones were wrapped in flesh and inhabited by feelings and thoughts and blood flowing. And organs vibrating. I think, oh, okay. Yeah. You feel the bones in here somewhere? Hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Something about that brings us a little closer. And in our lives, we have those experiences too that bring us closer, that touch us, that impact us, that make it harder for us to stay distant from the significance, the impact, and the transformative potency of what death is and what death represents for us. So just take a moment to notice as I'm speaking, because again, there's quite a few words here, and words can go and spin around and think, oh yeah, that sounds good, or oh, I don't know about that, I don't like the way he does that, well, that sounds really well explained. All that kind of just noticing what's happening for you if you come into your body and just feel what it's like. Belly, heart. You may feel, or you may not feel something. It's okay. You don't need to be having an experience here. But if you are, see if you can welcome it. And if you're just quite comfortably listening and feeling, you know, open or not open or whatever to the topic, just let yourself know that too. So it's just, in terms of a contemplative practice, we want to keep just checking in with what's happening. So this, in a way, distance we have from the truth, the reality of death, is artificially constructed and upheld in our society, in a more traditional culture or situation or in the natural world. And death is all around. And in fact, for us it is too, but we kind of organised to not meet it too much, so far as we can. And of course, sometimes we have that choice taken away from us. And it just comes into our life. I had a friend who I was fond of, and I'd met him while travelling in India, and he was a key person in a charity working with impoverished street people in Calcutta, which is where I met him. I spent some time there in India. And one day, actually here in South London, when he was around about 30, a similar age, he was just walking with a friend through his house, I think it was his house, yeah. And he just fell to the ground. Perfectly healthy young man in the prime of his life, just fell to the ground, fainted, collapsed, and within 2-3 minutes he was dead. His friend was with him as it happened, he just saw it happen. His wife wasn't there, his little daughter wasn't there, he didn't get to say goodbye. It was a blood clot in the brain, aneurysm, and yeah, death came just like that. He was gone, John. He was no longer. And it's just like that. It happens when it happens. Rather, interestingly, powerfully, poignantly, his friend was sitting in the room when I talked about this 2 years ago here in London. I didn't expect that. It's not so far away from us. And whether it's something as shocking as that, but just suddenly, it's like, you know, there's no apologies involved. There's no, it could have been nicer if I could have said goodbye, or I would have liked to say goodbye to this person. Not an option. Just gone. And something kind of shocking about that, if we actually let it in, if we let ourselves feel it, it might equally be just seeing a creature, a cat or a rabbit, depending whether you live in a city or the country, you know, squashed on the side of the road. You just realise that was a living creature. And then just, again, in a moment, gone, dead. And, you know, this kind of, we could say, unpleasant mess, or we could say, my gosh, look at what happened here. Rather than just, oh, I don't want to look at that, but I'm pleasant. You know, we don't look at it so much until it's our own cat. And one of my cats was run over two years ago. Just not far from the house. And I found it still warm. And just kind of like, oh. And it's not just a cat. It's actually like one's heart got run over. Most of us know this. We know this kind of experience. But what is it to let it in? To let in the vulnerability of our situation here. It's an old building. It's probably safe. Wouldn't be here if it wasn't probably safe. A friend of mine was in an old building a few years ago and walked out of the room about a second before, with absolutely no anticipation of this, the ceiling completely just fell out of it and hit the ground. And everything in the room was just flattened. And kind of turned around and looked back through the door at the dust and the rubble and realised that he'd been that close to still being in the room when the ceiling came down with no warning. Just, whoa. And it's moments like those where we just suddenly realise, not just that the impact of death when it comes is something beyond our words, if we let it in. But we're actually close to it. We're close to it all the time. Our life is lived, if we're not conscious of it, in the shadow of death. And if we make it conscious, it's lived in the light of death. And I hope over this weekend, some sense of what that light might offer will be part of what we explore and receive. It can sound like, you know, it's a bit of a kind of macabre or depressing, miserable topic, really. Why would we want to go and talk about or reflect on that? And maybe some of your friends or family thought, you know, what are you doing that for? You know, it's going to be a sunny day. We could go to the park. You know, we could have some fun. You know, great day to go on the London Eye or the Tate Modern or whatever, neither of which seem to be that far from here. Yet we're here. So something in us is perhaps also in contact with the, you know, the reality of the soft human body. Soft. It's really soft. Squishy. You know, when it encounters hard things, it sort of recoils or, you know, it goes, ouch. And the softness comes with a vulnerability. The vulnerability to accident, to illness, to ageing. And inevitably to death. This is so for us all. And we know this. It's interesting, isn't it? We know it. No, yeah. Come on, it's not as if I've said anything that any of you didn't know yet. It's something about turning towards it, isn't it? Like when we just let ourselves stop and in a more contemplative way, let it in. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Indian spiritual classic, there's a conversation that takes place between Arjuna, who's really the hero in a way, and Krishna, who's his charioteer and representing wisdom, you could say. And Arjuna asks Krishna, fully aware of his status, shall we say, with your vast and divine vision of the world, what's the greatest miracle that you see? And Krishna responds to him. He says, you know, the greatest miracle I see is that while people see death happening to others all around them, they somehow believe it will not happen to them. We get that? That there's something in us that can't quite get that this applies to me too. That I will not escape this. And so the Buddha suggested, amongst other things, to contemplate this regularly, to come back to this again and again and again, as a practice that actually brings light into our life. So one of the things he suggested for his time was what he called the charnel ground contemplations. And in the Buddha's day, in a lot of places, bodies weren't buried. They were just placed in a certain area on the outskirts of the village or town and left there for the creatures, wild creatures, to eat or to just sort of rot away as they did. And he said, you know, it's good to go and sit and look at those things and see. And the body's been placed there, maybe still warm. And to contemplate, oh, this will happen to me too. My body will not escape this. This is the phrase he suggested using. To watch it as it slowly decomposes, or visit it regularly and say, oh, this will happen to my body. Once it's a pile of bones, this too, my body will not escape this. And the bones eventually ground up to dust. And yeah, this body will become that. Maybe the process our bodies go through will be a little bit more clean and sanitized, but in terms of the reality, yeah, this is what happens to this body. This soft, vulnerable, and yet precious living thing. And this is the practice of what the Buddha called Maranasati. Mara being death. It's also the word used for the sort of the force of delusion and blindness in the mind. Sometimes it's personified as sort of like a sort of evil or distorting sort of demonic character, but it represents equally death. Mara is death. Mara Nasadi is the contemplation of death. And so this is something we'll be practicing, to contemplate. And it's in actually the five reflections that the Buddha sort of suggested I'll give you the actual word. The Buddha suggested in every day, this is five subjects for frequent recollection. He said, to contemplate, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing to me, will become otherwise. Will become separated from me. This is something the Buddha suggested reflecting on a daily basis. And so, just again, letting those reflections just land with you a little. There's a epitaph in a graveyard, which I believe is in Norfolk. So I haven't been there to confirm this, but so I've been told. That is really somebody's message and invitation and teaching on this topic that I'd like to share with you before we just shift the form a little. And on this graveyard, in the headstone, is inscribed the message: "Remember, friend, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you must be. Prepare yourself to follow me." Interesting last words. And beautiful offering. So this contemplation is actually part of our preparation. Not just for death, but for a life that's truly alive. And because if we have this tendency to not really fully take on the truth and let ourselves be affected by the truth, it's useful to bring it in this way. And so we're going to have a little time now where you can, if you need, give yourself a drink or use the bathrooms. We'll take about half an hour. And if you'd like to go for a walk, you're very welcome and invited and even encouraged to just go for a walk a little bit around. You might want to stay more in the building, but there won't be that much space to move. So you're welcome just to go out. If you have a timepiece, it would be good. It's just coming up to 11:15. And we'll gather back in here at 11:45. And what I'd like you to do over this time, now you might, you know, if you need to get a cup of tea or do something, it might involve some small interaction, but not to go out looking for interaction. See if you can stay with yourself and just see which of these phrases that I'm going to offer makes some contact with you or that you feel might be useful, because there's different ways you can do this, but it's really just to contemplate the fact of our mortality. To see. And the phrase that I tend to find most useful for this is just to reflect quietly internally, I too am going to die. Just like dropping a pebble into a pond and letting the ripples flow out. Do you have a sense of that? It's like, it's not like repeating it, da, 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 da. It's not, oh my God, we're all going to die, you know, sort of like disaster striking, because contemplating it doesn't make it at all less or more likely to happen immediately. It really doesn't. There's no evidence for that. Yeah? So one could say, you know, I too. Rather than I am going to die, which kind of, I don't know if you feel the difference in that. You could find that, but I too. It's like we are part of that for to whom which this is subject, we're subject to this. I too am going to die. Not just these other people have seen die or heard about their death. I too am going to die. Or it might be the time of my death is unknown. The time of my death is unknown. But my death is certain. Or death, my death is certain. Its time is unknown. Partly why we kind of keep distant from it is because it is an unknown and we don't deal easily with the unknown. Most of us. So contemplating death is bringing us into contact with the unknownness of when this profoundly significant event is going to take place. And of course brings us into contact with the fact that we don't necessarily know exactly what it's going to be like or what's going to happen next, if anything. It could be that nothing is what happens next after death. Then it could be that something. But we have no idea. We have no idea. And I'm not suggesting you, I'll come back to this one probably, have to have some idea that there is or isn't something beyond death. That's really not relevant or necessary. Whatever your position or lack of it there is fine. So but just think, just come back to it. You might walk, you might look around, you might notice, how does it affect me? To just now and then, and I don't mean repeating it again and again and again, as I said this morning, just drop it in. I too am subject to death. And just let it land. And walk a little, look a little. breathe, feel, sun or the wind or the things. What you might notice is if your mind starts going into reading something or looking at something and you start to get lost in it, just come back. Okay, here I am. And just bring in the contemplation, the reflection again. Or, you know, death. My death is certain. The time of my death is unknown. Do you have a sense of that? Have a sense of how to kind of maybe work with that? Okay, great. So we'll take half an hour now for that.